opinion to what the to consider and make a decision. One, it's not necessary to have a separate financial management of Parliament. So I would just say that your parliamentary autonomy, as indicated in the Constitution, can still be protected with such a separate system in the PSM. And that there's a practical problem with going the route Parliament wants to go by having a separate piece of legislation. One, there's a uniform norms and standards on our cancer across legislation. Thank you. have to agree. We have to sit together and come to an agreement. After consultation, we'll consult, we'll get your views, we'll consider the pros and cons, the advantages and disadvantages, and make our own decision. My interpretation is that from the UK, from the Federation of Power, Parliament must have that total control. But as indicated, basically, then to the second specific concern of the National Treasury, where they say the Parliament or the bill's attempt to distinguish between your appropriated funds and Parliament's own funds, which would mean the own funds or rollover funds in the previous year, is the artificial. I don't think it means that it's tangible money when you go into the account to become one. Money from X and money from Y, but it's one of them, so it's illegal that we cannot see. That's illegal reality. But in terms of the book, it's not says that you have unauthorized expenditure from your own funds. You cannot authorize that unauthorized expenditure using your appropriated funds, and use your own funds. So we don't get this kind of cross-pollination. And that to me makes sense. One must look at the fact of each case, whether it is not restrictive on Parliament not to be able to use your appropriated funds to authorize unauthorized expenditure. It will depend on why that money was unauthorized and what was the use of it. By definition, it is unauthorized expenditure in profit. Even though it was necessary to spend that money, there are systems in place to get environment or to get an adjustment appropriation or whatever. So I don't find that concern, once again, an insurmountable obstacle, Honourable Chair. The third bullet point on specific concerns, National Treasury says that the unsatisfactory PFMA provisions on expenditure before appropriation is passed are reproduced in the bill. That's correct. I'm now looking at paragraph 8 of my document. Now, I indicate there that the specific concerns in my eyes relate to clause 19.2.8 of our crop law book. 19.2.8 says that you cannot use money, I'm talking now about money to get from the National Revenue Fund before the appropriation is passed. 19.2.8 says you cannot use that money for any other purpose other than the purpose of the previous year, which is a provision that's not been reproduced in the new draft financial management of public finance management book. I'll just quickly have a look at that. Quite a lengthy document, so I won't go through everything in detail. But the new draft of the PFMA or PFMB does not reproduce that part. So you can use your 40% of your national revenue fund before your budget is passed for any purpose, new priority, which releases you a little bit. It takes a bit of a restraint off the purpose for that money. So to solve that, and I would agree with National Treasury that that's inappropriate, then let's just remove 19.2.8 from the bill. And look at the wording, and very similar wording except for 19.2.8 in the new draft financial and public finance management bill. Okay, the fourth bullet point, part of the restriction on borrowing and the public-private partnership. Now, the National Treasury has indicated that we are limiting ourselves to the advantage that gives us. Like the PFMA, the FOPLA bill says that you cannot issue guarantees and take out loans except for your housing subsidies or car pools and so on, very limited areas, credit card and so on that you can do. Now, the new draft, the public finance management bill allows the Minister of Finance, to borrow money, to authorize other government departments or state entities to borrow money. There's also quite detailed provision on the public-private partnerships and money coming in there. Now, my issue, or my opinion on this, Honourable Chair, is that it might be useful for Parliament to be able to borrow money. Now, who's going to authorise that? Is it going to be, in terms of separation of powers, Parliament, Treasury, the Speaker and the Chairperson acting jointly, and so on? It gets a bit complicated in Parliament context. So one point. The other point is, do we need that? And so that's a question I cannot really answer. I'm not always privy to all the financial needs of Parliament, how we get that money. But the issue is, if Parliament has come this far with the present provision, are we in a financial problem? Do we need that freedom to be able to go and borrow money? Certainly, again, if we want to have that freedom, we cannot just reproduce what the new new public finance management bill is saying. We cannot there again request the Minister of Finance to authorize Parliament to borrow money. I haven't said in the beginning, but one can repeat it. I've said it before at the meeting of this committee. Even the PFMA says the controlling and supervisory functions of the Treasury must be performed by Parliament, by the Speaker and the Chairperson acting jointly. So if the Minister of Finance has that controlling function with the treasury, which is ever one of those fields, the draft at the moment says it's a minister, then one can start arguing and say, well, then in that case, the speaker and the chairperson acting jointly must be able to also borrow from the House of Parliament. And that's a big issue. One cannot just take that up like the question isn't really needed. So I don't see that as an insurmountable obstacle to proceed with this bill or any changes necessary in this bill. I think it's now the fifth bullet point, section 55 or clause 55 of the popular bill. National Treasury feels that that is insufficient or incomplete. Now, clause 35 refers to transfer from Parliament to other entities. Said before transferring any funds from Parliament to any other entity, the accounting officer must obtain a written assurance from the entity that it implements effective and efficient transfer and transparent financial management and internal control systems, etc., etc. Now, my understanding of that, was Honourable Chair, is that that relates to money that Parliament will transfer for goods or services or for membership. The IPU or the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association and so on. It remains taxpayers' money, and of course one doesn't want to transfer those monies to a corrupt bank account or some kind of problematic institution. So I'm not sure what National Treasury has in mind here. It seems that they think that these monies that Parliament will be transferring is also money that we will be transferring to constitutional or to state institutions supporting constitutional democracy, like the Auditor General and so on. I'm saying that because it seems to be a tenet in the new draft public finance management book, where Parliament will be, from the budget, make specific transfers to these institutions. And I don't know if that is what National Treasury is worried about, whether one needs to elaborate on those things. But that is a whole new policy issue. Now, I'm not sure how that must be incorporated in this one now. If the idea is to change the way these institutions are getting their money from the National Revenue Fund, whether they must get it through Parliament, or whether they need to report to Parliament and cut out, which is the Department of Justice, is the President's Department at the moment for these institutions, then that decision must still officially reach me. I haven't seen anything official that must be done in this book. But as I say, the concern of present clause 35, maybe National Treasury can highlight the specific concern there, because I don't see the concern. We're not dealing with the same talking past each other there. It's almost as if we want to say, when we do these transfers, then the following must apply. All the budgetary control system that applies to the government department will now be applicable to your Human Rights Commission or something like that. And that is in any case there, but that's the difference. That's the Public Finance Management Act that will take care of that. I want to move on to the specific concern around clause 43. Clause 43, I don't know if the committee and honourable chair remembers, this is an issue to Secretary of Parliament also didn't quite understand. Clause 43 says that if the accounting officer concludes a contract in respect of a tender or a quotation or other bid other than the one that was recommended, the executive authority and the auditor general must be informed in writing. Now, a tender or a quotation, that is there's an big administrative issue around these things. The court kind of explained that it's an administrative decision you're taking, so you must have reasons why you're taking it. You have the Referential Procurement Policy Framework Act and so on, which sets out how one must consider tenders and which tenders must then be awarded. Now, the issue in the beginning was for the Secretary of Parliament in this clause, but surely there are unforeseen issues that could come up, for instance, with a quotation. One might get three quotations. Your committee or line manager might recommend the cheapest, the most affordable one of those three. But Parliament might have had problems with the delivery of that specific service provider, for instance. Parliament might difference in price is not that big. My consumer safety service provider gives everybody a fair opportunity to see what kind of service they can deliver. Now, these issues must, of course, be contained in a policy. So the issue at that point was, what if the policy allows the accounting officer to make certain deviations or amendments to one that was recommended? Tenders, of course, are much more problematic, but similar issues could arise in tenders. So the Secretary of Parliament at that initial stage said that the clause should rather read that if the accounting officer decides to contract on the basis of a tender or a quotation or another bid outside the policy, then the accounting officer, then the executive authority and the Auditor General must be informed about it. But the way it is at the moment is a little bit half-baked. The committee at the time proceeded with the clause as it is at the moment. I think one of the main issues was when it comes to tenders is pretty much a fixed approach. If you have a policy around tenders and your tender committee has made a recommendation, there is no scope for the accounting officer to deviate from that. So for me, it is almost as if the committee has taken a decision to remain with this, although there are concerns from the Secretary of Parliament. However, what the Treasury is now bringing in to say, and best value for money, that's sort of an add-on to the clause. I think the committee can decide whether it actually clarifies things or not. For me, it doesn't take the matter anywhere. It doesn't actually address the specific concern that we as administration of parliament still have with that clause. And I add there in, I think it's my paragraph 11 on page 3 of my document. When one look at the proposal in clause 218 of the draft public finance management book, that wording that the Treasury is recommending here is not even taken up there. I don't think it's necessary. I don't think it's going to take the matter anyway. One can also put it in the Constitution. Sets out actually those standards of transparency. I'm sorry. Now, the specific concern National Treasury has with clauses 44 and 46 of the proposal, I think are well placed. And those are the clauses which say that members cannot participate in any kind of tender committee. And then 46 provides for the prohibition of contracts, including any person in the employ of the state. Now, these are sort of lessons learned from the Municipal Finance Management Bill and the Public Finance Management Act. And they seem to be unnecessarily restrictive. When one looks at the new draft PFMP, there's a clause that's inserted there that says if it may, and it's important to say if it may result in a conflict of interest, not if it does result in a conflict. Appears that it's going to result in a conflict of interest, then these prohibitions should go through. However, a tender for parliament on which a member or members are sitting, for me there will always be a conflict of interest appearing. And if it's on the face, unless one goes into the details to say, well, the specific tender is for security of parliament and the member has no interest in security. It's very difficult to see how you in any case will allow a member of parliament on a tender committee when it's a contract for parliament. What it's all about. Be that as it may, I think the concern of National Treasury is well placed. It would be good in both clauses 44 and 46 to put in a provider that says if it may result in a conflict of interest. I would especially support it in terms of 46. The next concern of the National Treasury, here I have to revert to my legal language because they say they aver that it's inappropriate for the executive authority to prescribe internal audit standards and financial reporting format. I disagree, Honourable Chair. As I say, Section 3 of the PFMI already states that the executive authority, in short, must perform the controlling and supervisory functions of the National Treasury. In my opinion, the Treasury for Parliament is the executive authority, and it would be up to them to then set up your internal audit standards and your format for financial statements. In the spirit of cooperation, in the spirit of having uniform norms and standards, clearly there will be a lot of borrowing, if not wholesale borrowing, from what the National Treasury itself prescribes. But once again, it's a legal point that that prescription might be adopted wholeheartedly by Parliament, might also not. But Parliament needs to decide that. And who in Parliament has decided? It would be Parliament's Treasury, the executive authority. And that Treasury is, unlike the National Treasury, this Treasury is accountable directly to the Houses, in that they are elected by the Houses. The National Treasury, of course, is accountable under the Constitution, where Parliament must make an oversight. So it's a slight difference, but there is strong accountability still there. The last three bullet points, Honourable Chair, I must admit I didn't quite distinguish the cat and the dog there. I don't really know what is meant there. The first one says there's no provision made for regulation and alignment of remuneration and other benefits. I don't know whether this is saying to members or to members of staff or officials. Whichever way, I don't think this will intend to deal with those issues. It will intend to deal with those issues and must make a policy decision and then write all those in. But at the moment, there's no specific provision regulating remuneration and conditions of service for Parliament itself. We once again operate in the spirit of the public service. So the bill doesn't attempt to go there. The same with members. We have the remuneration for political office there as Act, and I think that would be the right place to deal with issues of payment of members and of course the commission set up. The second last bullet point says there's no provision made for financial management arrangements relating to other organs of state. I'm aware that these are issues. I mentioned in my documents the space utilization project. Every morning we see Parliament being worked on. That is a capital investment. The money is supposed to come from public works. Parliament plays a huge role in supervising and setting out requirements there. So there's a lot of coordination that must be done to have those contracts run smoothly. Exactly how to sort those things out, I'm not aware of. I'm not briefed on these sensitive issues, especially issues of security and so on. Also support for the Office of the Presidency and the Office of the Leader of Government Business in Parliament. Those are all issues where there's a lot of coordination between government departments. I'm not aware of any big problems that have arisen there, but should there be, I mentioned it in my document that one can then look at your policies or your rulemaking by Parliament Treasury to solve those issues. But I'm not aware how we can solve those issues in this book right now, other than to set out our norms and standards. And the last bullet point, I do not understand financial implications of international agreements. We're talking here about international agreements and treaties, conventions, protocols, which Parliament needs to approve in terms of the Constitution. Or are we talking here, for instance, our friendship agreements like we have with the Chinese Parliament? What are the issues there? We're talking about international agreements in terms of being a member of the IPU, the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association. What financial arrangements should be made there? Do we need to make special arrangements for these issues, or do the normal unified standards for your financial control apply to them? I think that concern is, as I say, in all fairness to everybody involved, just a bullet point. I don't have enough flesh on those ones to say anything further than that. I can just conclude, Honourable Chair, by saying that I'm aware that the Cabinet, I don't know if they've approved the new draft public finance management book. I know it's before Cabinet, or I don't know if they've approved it yet. That will, of course, bring a lot of changes in question for the committee that is, do we actually wait until that bill sees the light and be passed, and one has been speculated when that will happen, or do we take what National Treasury has said here, we look at some of the draft provisions of the new public finance management bill, try to amend it so that this will work in the meantime, and should there be further amendments necessary, that is what Parliament does. Core function, thank you.
Okay, thanks, okay, that's the top of this document. I think two gentlemen, quite, you've been constantly referring to this public finance management bill. I don't know that the committee would have to come up with something. I wouldn't want us to have this from an alliance or not. That will cause us a problem. If it doesn't feel the night, I want us to like to control the way apply it fine. You just have to work as a single thing. But also, a question number three as well, in your response, you mentioned that you're not too sure, you're not clear as to what that actually means. My question would be, make any attempt to clarify that the treasurer will come here. If not, why? If so, what are the other parliamentary questions? But it's the normal format of the parliamentary question. But I think it lasts just sort of. If then we've got to see if Mr. Ferreira is here, perhaps we can try and clarify some of those so that we can move forward. Not that if we cannot clarify them, we can proceed, but it will be a little accepted if we can clarify them. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
If this then get one to specifics, but those are just general remarks that I would want to take on board. But the other thing also which I want us to try now, I do not want us to reopen this process. You know, I think because of the long time that left the time the last year to the tendency of what it really need to go back, even on some of the things that was committed itself. Where we live, these things are too long.
Mine are just broad, general questions. I mean, speaking, and the other one would be a question to Mr. Jenkins, because in our last interaction, I can't recall today, we requested Mr. Jenkins to remove the auditing of funds of political parties by the Auditor General, and that has not been done. And we did explain why it should be done, and I thought there was one thing about that. The other issue that I want to raise, let me start from this point, that indeed I agree with the separation of powers and that we should proceed with this legislation. However, we must be mindful of the fact that, and we must acknowledge, and that's a reality, we can't run away from it, that the judiciary would also come up with its own legislation. So whatever we do here, we must be consistent. We can't just be doing things conveniently because it's Parliament and we're members of Parliament. I think that would be wrong. From my side, that would be totally wrong. So we have to be consistent so that when the judiciary comes with their own legislation, we should be saying, yes, this is how we have dealt. You can't then say, we tighten up the screws because it's the judiciary. Then, I mean, that shows inconsistency. For me, the issue, I don't want to get into the legal arguments. I want to look at it politically, take a political decision. For me, like I've said, the the issue of profiting the legislation is important. But we need to clarify what are the norms and standards. Because we shouldn't then apply certain norms and standards here. And then when provinces come with their own approaches and we find that the center doesn't hold. Because for me, I would repeat it. I don't want to see a fragmentation of financial management in South Africa. Then the center doesn't hold. You know, then just have various branches that do their own running their own financial system. For me, that's paramount. And therefore, we need to carefully apply our mind to what extent we want to reference this bill to the PFMA. I think we need to apply our mind, because if we become approach this thing in which a manner which is convenient to us as members of parliament, then we must know we're creating our problems for ourselves tomorrow. And we shouldn't run away from this issue. We must face the matter. Tomorrow, legislators will have their own view. The judiciary will have their own view. And if there are inconsistencies, we must shoulder the blame. Nobody else. Nobody forced the bill on us. Not the executive, not the presiding officers. It's our bill. We must decide on it. Chair, that's my first point, of that we should take a broader discussion on the issue of norms and standards. And also, Chair, for me, I know people might be sensitive about the national treasury, might try to get around it. I don't want to create problems for future generations. Like when you say in 216.3, we say a decision to stop the transfer of funds due to a province in terms of 214 may be taken only, okay. I'm losing something here. Okay, I think it's 2162. We say the National Treasury must enforce compliance with the measures established in terms of exception 1 and may stop transfer of funds to an organ of state if that organ of state commits a serious or a system material breach of those measures. And those measures are stipulated in 2161, where we're talking about general recognized accounting practice, uniform expenditure classification, uniform treasury norms and standards. We must be clear about it, so that we shouldn't create conflicts for tomorrow. If Parliament is in consistent breach of this thing, who to stop the fund? I mean, people might get around it and say, no, that can't be negotiated. I don't believe in negotiations. I believe in negotiation, but I believe the legislation must be clear, so that we can create problems for people tomorrow. The other matter, the Chair, is around the Accounting Standards Board. If you check the PFMA 89, findings of the board say the Accounting Standards Board must set standards of generally recognized accounting practice as required by Section 2161A of the Constitution on the annual financial statements, and then it continues. Of department, party entities, constitutional institutions, parliament, and provincial legislatures. And that you must recommend the minister effective dates of implementation of the standards for the different categories. I'm not an expert in this matter. We must be clear what does this thing mean. Because I see at one stage there's an argument around it, and we must be clear. I don't want to see a situation where we are saying, some of these things are decided by the presiding officers. That can't be correct, because clearly we're past legislation and we can't be substituting legislation through other means. We must be clear. That's my point. I've gone through the legal opinion, Chair. It doesn't matter unless National Treasury and Parliament clearly state to us so that we should be able to take political decisions. What are these norms and standards and all these other issues?
Thank you, Chair. Just to follow up on what Mwatu has said, specifically in terms of that bullet point 6 of your report or your response, in consultation to offer consultation and the separation of powers, I'm really concerned, because if you read the Constitution and that 216, 1 and 2 specifically, and you say that the minister must introduce a money bill. But if there's separations of powers, it means that he might not agree with that. But you know, and there can be a huge conflict of interest and a conflict between, you know, the parliament, the executive, and the minister who has introduced that, who might not believe in that, and who might not think that it's a proper thing to do. And I see huge conflicts also with the provisions of the Constitution. And I'm saying to myself, what if the minister doesn't agree? What happens then? Who's accountable for any of the transactions? If the minister introduces, but he's not accountable, so who's accountable then for money that gets spent? And in terms of the Constitution, he is in the last instance responsible for that and accountable for that, obviously via Treasury. Then in terms of your bullet point 10, and that clause 35, in terms of transfer of funds to entities and state institutions, I can have empathy for your point that, you know, certainly there's certain transfers that must be required in terms of various associations and things like that. And my question is, shouldn't one then identify the type of transfers that should be allowed? Maybe get around that point. And on point 12, where you refer to clause 44 and 45, and that's in terms of that conflict of interest. In 46E, it refers to substantial interest. What does a substantial interest mean? Or is that open for interpretation? And obviously then, differences of opinion in terms of what is substantial interest. Thank you, sir.
How I so wish we could be pursuing a bill without any body in mind, minister, anybody in mind, current speaker or chair of the SOP, so that we talk principles. For me, that gets to be very, very personal. Looking to the future, you are able to sustain any decision you shall have taken in keeping that principle. And that point could also be talking directly to your bullet point 10. You did allude to the fact that the borrowing powers, so bullet point 9, sorry, the borrowing powers we are talking about must be borrowing powers that talk equally to the future, so that we're not talking to the current and the present. We might still have to debate that one. Whether or not you should really be talking in that direction. Chair, you made a statement that says we must not reopen the deal. I'm not too sure what that means, because this is a long time ago.
I wish you could just confirm that.
No, I don't agree. We've had this deal for a while. And then, as you're correctly pointing out, that time changes. You also are influenced by environment at any given point in time. But as they say, it's only a wise man who changes his mind, but informed by conditions, obviously. Without having to drive on any specific matter in this regard, I thought, let me just make a general statement. I don't have any specific issues, fortunately, in that regard. Now, my question that I was having in that regard there was, what are the timelines that we have on this bill of open collection? The reason why I'm asking that question is because we seem to have a number of issues that must still, you know, resolve on this bill. Among others, you know, is the debate, or some of the debates that have been raised, especially with the provincial legislators and their role in society, this issue, and also our own NCOP concurrently having to look into these matters that we're dealing with. Another issue, Chair, on clause 11, or rather on bullet point 11, referring to clause 43. Though a mention is made here on clause 46 that says prohibition on contracts, no contract to provide goods or services to Parliament may be awarded, among others, to a personal employee of the state. I assume that to be equally meaning even the officials within Parliament. If that is the case, maybe I don't know if it is clear enough or understood enough, even by those officials of Parliament. If it is not, maybe you might also wish to be a lot more specific. I would say those few for now, and then perhaps they're also expecting some answers on the timeline for this bill, for us to be able to understand as to how best we move forward. Thank you, Chair. On item number 13 of this report we got from Andrew Jenkins, he mentioned that he disagrees with the concern of the National Treasury regarding clause 50 and 56. Now, if I understand correctly, Treasury's concern is obviously around standards of the internal audit unit and of the financial statement. I share the concern of the National Treasury in this regard, but I understand the difficulty of referring to the PFMA. So I know that there's an audit committee that's going to be established as well, and it's set up in such a way that it has independence and expertise, etc. Perhaps then it should be the audit committee that then should be deciding what the formats of these things should be. Thanks, Chair.
Now, looking at this legal opinion in the text of the article, that it is actually the National Trade that is supposed to the mandate as expenditure of government and all sales government and the accounts. Now, and Parliament is also saying that it is part of the government. At the end of the day, it has to account to the and then the question is that it's not 216 or maybe 216, 216. Now, in line with that, as the Corporate Law has pointed out, whatever any government department or any government organ of state, what it does by its financial constraints, it has to conform to the standards. Also in line with the law, the GAF in line with the GAF. So I think it should be wrong if we say now Parliament should have its own accounting standards or its own process of accounting, different from other state organs. So I agree that actually it should be uniform. That certainly cannot say Parliament must do what to say because as it says there, Parliament is not concerned. But I think as far as accounting standards, as far as numbers of them, I think it should be in line with the other government departments and other official legislation. Then imagine if the judiciary can have its own law, I mean its own bill, but I think the way they account should also be safe, like in other countries, because they all, at the end of the day, fall under trade, I mean, that regulates the nation.
Take us from this. With regard to the timeline, Mr. Justice, if we can't finalize this tomorrow,
Honorable Chair, I might have understood my instructions incorrectly, referring to the issue of the AG that was supporting political policy fund that they received from Parliament. I can't remember getting an instruction on that as well. But I certainly feel that it should be removed, that political parties have their own recognized auditors, like the policy of the president. Anything that's audited, any account that's audited by the Auditor General, of course, gets referred to Scotland. So the question is, Scotland, the right body to be looking into the way that political parties spend their funds, are they not really creating potential for disaster? And Scotland is really trying to be non-political. Scotland is an account of political parties. Surely there are statements that can be made, and can be end up in quite an explosive situation. That in its own is not the only reason why the AG is not the appropriate body. I think, and I did email the Auditor General, their legal advisor, who gave me details at the beginning of March, I think, so I don't know if it was he didn't respond, and I just asked him the committee of meeting would he like to come and present the Auditor General's view on this. From my documentation from 2006, the Auditor General did make a submission saying that they don't have the capacity to do this. So, whether that's still the case, I don't know. We have a new Auditor General in the past. There was a restructuring exercise, so I don't really know if that's still there. But I didn't get any response, and that's what I certainly think is in the process. If I may be so blunt, I'm not prepared to say Parliament is deciding to make its own bill in terms of financial management because it can. The national legislative authority in terms of the constitution. The judiciary is not, neither are the provinces. If one reads that addendum to the legal opinion of Mr. Ramsey, he makes a good point saying that Parliament has the legislative authority to prescribe financial management for provincial legislatures because the provinces do not have this authority. The provinces, in terms of their legislative authority, they actually don't have the authority to make the law for their own financial management. Parliament must make that. Now there is, I'm aware of at least one province that has made such a law. But it is a challenge and not a decision. But my view, at this early stage of my legal career, is that is also be the so within that legislative norm that we can set for provinces, they can then come and make their own rules and regulations. There must be a site. There's a second quarter. There must be a site provision in the Parliament's national legislation which is going to guide problems and not. And as I said, if that is in the bill, then there's a certain thing to be changed. But what I want to say is that provinces in the judiciary cannot by themselves come forward and say, we will make our own laws, like Parliament. The judiciary certainly can lobby or make a submission to Parliament. And the Parliament at that point might as well decide to make it a chapter in the new public finance management. And on that point, I can say, there's nothing that says that Parliament cannot be a chapter in the public finance management. We can. Provided that we strictly follow the provisions, then that there is no treasury oversight of the Parliament's accounts at that point. Parliament must be in control of that. Just like the judiciary should be in charge of their accounts. Should there be a chapter in the new PFMA? Now, as I said, Parliament is a political decision because we can make our own laws, make our own separate legislation.
Meaning, unless you have it in your hand.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, the issue of norms and standards, okay, so my opinion, and I agree with that, is that the norms and standards in terms of parliament have been enforced by parliament. By parliament's case, not by national case. I've spoken about the issue that we have decided that parliament to go with our own will instead of a separate information of practical business. If I can then get to avoid further confusion, the issue of the norms and standards, the issue of the accounting standards, board, and so on. The bill as it stands is not clear, and I would agree with that. The bill as it stands refers to the executive authority that has been descriptions of the standards and obviously ensure that these are enforced. You've had a suggestion from Dr. George that maybe the audit committee must play a role here. One can also try to be more specific in the legislation to say that in the wherever we refer to the executive authority that must prescribe norms and standards, enforce norms and standards, these must be done with, it's not going to be too strong because it's always think of parliament's autonomy, with due regard to the norms and standards of the general recognized accounting practices. But my view is that we cannot allow somebody like the accounting standard or an institution like the accounting standard board to set our norms and standards. Simply because the accounting standard board is not an independent body that is established by the Minister of Finance, So one must look at the detail there, but certainly one can try and put something in the legislation which doesn't give the executive authority a wide discretion in determining or enforcing the norms, but make it more compliant with the rest of government by referring broadly to what is happening elsewhere in government and say that this must be taken into consideration. And that way you also give certain grants for the executive authority to adopt the uniform norms and standards set up as a basis. So that can happen without having to jeopardize the constitutional autonomy that's required of Parliament. I would like to move on to the question of Mr. Marais, Honourable Chair, on paragraph 6, the issue of accountability. Yes, there's potential for conflict. The easiest example is I remember during the Clinton era there was disagreement about budget. I think now with President Bush as well there was a disagreement of the budget and the Senate or the House of Representatives and the Senate Congress, they just don't have grants so they don't have parts of the budget. And then there's no money going to government and government officials. That's a crisis. And it has to be resolved. Whether that's healthy or now unhealthy is a different debate. But the potential is there. Now the question that you asked that Parliament doesn't have to decide its budget in consultation with government after consultation with Parliament Finance. I cannot see a way around that, Honourable Chair, and Parliament will have to decide the minister will introduce if there's a conflict. It tends to be late night sitting around and need to try and resolve it because the alternative to that is of course that the country as a whole cannot move forward. You have your provisions to draw money from the National Revenue Fund if the budget is not passed in time. There's specific provisions, if I remember correctly, in the Municipal Finance Management Act, which says the budget must be passed within a certain time. If it's not passed, then provinces and like the following interventions and so on. That, of course, doesn't apply at national level. I should just say that politically, those disputes will have to be resolved. And I agree here we must think of principles and not the present state of the majority party really having the power to decide these issues even within themselves because and that have a big majority. We must think what happens if you have what we call the hung parliament of some sort. And these will be difficult issues. I cannot see a specific way of getting around it, but we cannot say that the Minister of Finance is the door that should be there. But that would be unconstitutional. The question about transfer, whether we should specify what is meant by the transfer, one could see a problem with that. Should we not mention that these transfers are transfers? At the moment, as it stands, all transfers are transfers. But Parliament doesn't transfer money to the subsidized items, which I thought is what the National Treasury has in mind when they said we should provide them. At the moment, as it still stands, the only transfer the Parliament will make is for services, for goods, for contracts, and membership to international organizations. So I don't find it really too problematic. What I do find problematic is your question around substantial interest. I don't know. There might be definitions. I'm not aware of them. Accounting standards, accounting far long, but certainly that clause 46 is tightly enough. There was a further question on clause 46 from Mr. Johnson on do parliamentary officials, or are parliamentary officials aware that we're also assisting them on contracts? Yes, I would think they are aware. They are employees of the state. As I say, what I would agree with the National Treasury on that is to say that these prohibitions should only apply if there may be a conflict of interest. But the question then is, as I say, with members of Parliament on tender committees, the member of Parliament is serving, being awarded a contract, how can there not be a conflict of interest or an apparent conflict of interest? If you're working for Parliament, Parliament is awarding a contract and you are bidding for it and you're allowed to work. I have a bit of a problem because what people out there would think that Parliament is dealing with some inbreeding exercise of getting money revolving around everybody that's representing Parliament and then maybe Parliament officials. I would have a problem with that person. Legally, if one puts it the way Treasury and I'm in agreement or what I agree with, to put this, if there may be a conflict of interest, one could say that it covers the issue of parliamentary staff bidding for contracts. It's a parliament of decide whether a staff member should get a contract or not. It must appear to be a contract. Whether you're working in different divisions or whether you're completely disliking each other because of the discrimination or whatever. But it certainly appears to a member of the public, in my opinion, that there's a contract. The parliament cannot decide to award a contract to one staff. What I think is very necessary in that course to make allowance for is for people in the employ of the state to be able to bid for contracts. Because Parliament takes itself away, Parliament takes itself to the people in the Ghana, to the corners of South Africa, and there might be people who could actually benefit from having a contract with Parliament. And these people might be in the employ of the state, being a part-time teacher, a part-time nurse, a part-time doctor. It might be somebody working for a municipality. Now, think of the unified public service that is something in the making. Somebody from a municipality might want to bid for a contract. It might be somebody with a very low level of income at the municipality can do with a contract like that, and there's no apparent conflict of interest. So one needs to allow that. So that is the main point that I was trying to drive home there. I can do a bit of research on substantial interest and come back to the commission on that. Mr. Johnson, the principal approach I also deemed is that to permeate your rulemaking exercise in any case, the timeline for the chair. The issue of provinces, on considering including them and so on, I think that's a policy question on the chair. As it stands at the moment, the NCC would have to take this bill to the provinces, because I think it will be a 70-cent bill. And it's normally paying it from there. I think I've answered the question on officials of Parliament. Dr. George, whether the audit committee will be the appropriate body to set auditing standards and the format of your financial statement. Then who's on the audit committee? I'm really not sure. In terms of the audit standards, one can actually think, because the audit committee is usually in charge of ensuring that there's an audit charter. comply with how the audit will be done. So there might be a good point that I'd first of all, I must admit I'm not a seasoned commercial lawyer on this topic, or an accountant, or a chartered accountant. But who should set the format for your financial statement in terms of the CFMA, the Minister of Finance, in terms of Parliament? I'm going to say it's the executive authority, the treasurer for the corruption of the executive authority, taking into account the general standards applicable in the public service on government reports, something in that time. We're going to have to go in this morning. But I honestly think that it should not be an audit committee that gets that far. And an audit committee, at this point in time, sometimes they meet four times a year. I think the requirement of the audit agenda that meets three times a year. So in that exercise, can they really play such an important role to set the standard of reviewing all these other issues? I would think that the one keeps it with forum effect. That treasury is accountable by the national treasury. I think that's the important point. I think I've also addressed the other question around the treasury and the standard that you do want to keep following.
Just very quickly, because I'm trying to understand and get to grips with your references as well. And obviously, Section 57 refers to National Assembly. May determine and control its internal arrangements, proceedings, and procedures, and make rules concerning its business with due regard to representativity, particularly participatory democracy, accountability, transparency, and public involvement. Then, if I read that with 216, where it says treasury control, national legislation must establish a national treasury and prescribe measures to ensure both transparency and expenditure control in each sphere of government by introducing. Now obviously, then one can ask, you know, is Parliament a sphere of government? And then 213. National Revenue Fund, and it's probably a question to you. It says here that there's a National Revenue Fund into which all money received by the national government must be paid, except money reasonably excluded by an Act of Parliament. So you actually want to motivate a special Act of Parliament where that money can go to separately, do I understand that correctly? And then in the other two, it's really, I'm trying to understand that by find it difficult because in the National Assembly doesn't specifically refer to budget, it refers to its internal arrangement. So in other words, if money has been, and I interpret it, if money has been appropriated to Parliament, then they can do their own business. But obviously to basically determine your own funds and just depend on the minister to introduce that. Sounds to me a bit of a conflict situation, and I'm not sure where these articles provide for that.
Okay, I'll take a quick response to from but what I would want us to do is whether today now or tomorrow, but I would want us now to just go into the door, because some of the questions that are coming up here are dealt with in greater detail in the door, and I don't know to what extent power to be able to encompass, because even the legal opinion itself seems to be degradation as far as I'm concerned. I went through it. Exactly. That's my problem. But I would actually want us to look at that, because it raises a lot of contradiction itself, which we would need to apply to our mind. And then the end of it. Yeah. Before you respond, Advocate, Mr.
Martin. I want to get that information.
You can open. Topic of
course. Yeah. I would want, before we proceed too far, I would want to have clarification from National Children. The practitioners and the implementers of the PFMA, their own experience. So that, you know, because still up to now, I don't know what these norms and standards are. So I would want them to explain to me what are the norms and standards. Because, I mean, if you look at 217 on procurement, we'd say that when an organ of state in the national or provincial or local sphere of government or any other institution identified, okay, then talks about an equitable, transparent, competitive, and cost effective. Does it mean that the parliament can have its own procurement policy is different from the rest of the government? You know, I'm just saying I need to know what are the norms and standards before I go along with this. Because if what we are fighting here is contrary to what is applicable, generally, that is the problem. So for me, that's a critical part.
And another interesting thing is that... another interesting thing is that, it also comes up in the legal thing. Why is National Treasury responsible for the process? Both ones. The Parliament also exercises oversight of National Treasury. Instead of clarifying this thing, for me it's complicated. That's fine.
Thank you, Chairperson. We're just delayed in another meeting. We once had the opportunity to look at some of the documentation. I've got a buttoned up voice. Two of the questions which you may have already tackled, so please just let me know. The one is, throughout the documentation, one sees the point of sphere and organ rather than arms of government, like executive, judiciary, and legislature. Is that for a particular reason, maybe? And the fourth, while saying that one only has authority or whatever political functioning constitutionally over the national sphere of funding, how could we get some explanation or clarification on the fact that it is only Parliament that can actually divide the budget, per se? You know, the national, the provincial, and local. It is not divided as local, per se. Divided up here, the allocation per se. And then that relates to, of course, the transfer and accountability. So it's when we're thinking of the interpretation of what Parliament's authority is in relation to Treasury, to me that hasn't been clearly explained, but if you're telling me it's explained in the legal document further on, then I'm covered.
I don't want to know. What are these numbers? There's a group that has for implementation of the PFM.
Yeah.
Just clarify.
Yeah, and even
if
that comes to the government,
what I've read from the PFMA on the accomplice number board, that's to be clarified for me that you can take.
I think norms and standards is a consistent application of financial management practices. if you speak to people that were part of the negotiations in 1994, the interesting bit is that the previous governments were not able to identify what the liabilities of government were, be it parliament, be it departments, be it provincial administrations, etc. And I think for us that is sort of symptomatic in terms of what we've continued to try to bring to the committee to say we feel that since 1994 we have a coherent financial management system, which means all of us look at procurement the same way. We apply international financial reporting standards in a consistent way. We budget consistently. Our line items are aligned so that when we look at the provincial education budget and we look at the national education budget and we look at what local government has got in its budget, it is the same line item and we all understand what it means. We can all roll it up into a financial statement for the country as a whole. And I think that's how we continuously argue to say, I mean, for me, to try and interrogate the separation of powers and the sort of natural tension there has to be between the different branches of government, which is Parliament or the legislature, the executive and the judiciary, to try and resolve a policy question with a legal opinion, I think it's problematic. And unfortunately, lawyers always get caught up in that, because I think there's a number of difficult questions one needs to ask and answer, and legal opinions can help us clarify that. But I mean, there is a contradiction in terms of 44 and 216. But similarly, at national, if you look at local government, we've got a legislature and we've got an executive in the same sphere. Local government, its political arm is constituted by the legislature as well as the executive. And I think, I mean, the question in terms of what is a branch and what is a sphere, how do you, Parliament is the legislature's branch within a national sphere. And how that relates to the executive and the judiciary, and how that happens at provincial level, and how that happens at local government level, are still things I think that we're thrashing out. I think from our side, in terms of norms and standards, and what I think we've argued consistently, is that we don't think that we should lose the gains we've got up to now in terms of a comprehensive financial management system. I think we've been very clear to say that the current relationship between Parliament and the executive in terms of, and I think between the legislature and the executive, and between the executive and the judiciary in negotiating or agreeing budget, expenditure items, etc., is an issue up for discussion, and on how we take that forward. But for me, it's a fundamental policy issue and a practical issue to say, do we want to go back to a situation where we can't say what the liabilities of our country is, but we can say what the liabilities of the legislature is, and but we can't roll it up. We can't have a financial statement for the country. We think that auditing standards are hugely different. How do we ensure that we comply with international financial reporting standards? And I don't think, I mean, I think the tension arises, and it's a healthy tension, to say that although the legislature has oversight of the executive, in some way the executive also needs to give direction to the legislature. I think that's the sort of tension in it, because if you look at the judiciary, how it interacts with Parliament and with the executive, it directs us. You say, wrong, do it this way. Then we go back to our legislation, or we go back to our administrative actions, and now we took decisions. And I don't think we should try and, I mean, yeah, I'm sort of babbling on, but I mean, I think the sort of point for us is to say, the gains that we've got in terms of practical coherence, in terms of how we approach financial management, which spans from line items to financial reporting standards to procurement, is what I think the SGC has argued, that we need to protect that.
So I wanted to use a rather frivolous example earlier. For instance, the section, I think it's 14, says everybody, well, that's later right, everybody has free speech in this country. Freedom of expression. But when that everybody comes to Parliament, you don't have a right. You only speak when it seems to be given to the members of the country. If I can put it like that. In spite of the fact that Parliament is open, and you must have so all I'm saying is one must read provisions in context. That's very important. And that brings me then to looking at section 54 and 216 in the context of the Constitution. Nowhere in the Constitution is there an issue, as Honourable Tuff said, where different arms or branches of government are said that you are autonomous and you are in control of your own site. That's not said anywhere. The Constitutional Court, in a few examples, gone up and said, what we read in the Constitution is that there's a clear principle of separation of powers. And the separation of powers means as follows, that you must have control over your function. So whereas Parliament has a function of oversight, maintaining oversight over the executive, and ensuring that they're compliant with legislation, if we do not have control over our budget, that might just be paying lip service to the Constitution. Because as we argue about a possible conflict between between the Minister of Finance and Parliament about determining a budget, should we say, no, let's avoid that conflict and allow the Minister and Parliament to agree? What if there can be no agreement? We're still sitting at the same problem. That's not when we say that's not happening in consultation. Now, we're now in the middle of 57 and 200. We're in no man's land, in my opinion. We're not in a constitution at all. And we're not going, trying to ignore 57 and just going into section 216 and saying treasury method. Should we go that way, the third option, to say, no, let national treasury determine. And those are usually official to national treasury consultation. Let them determine what the budget allocation to different departments will be, including Parliament. What's the worst case scenario? There's an agreement to give Parliament a budget in which we cannot fulfill our functions. So that is unconstitutional. So we're not reading 216, and which says the national treasury must be chosen. We're not reading in the context of that. To an extent, Parliament, in terms of the constitutional interpretation by the highest court, we must have control over our own budget, although it's not written in there. The issue of a separate act, and I can mention it, a separate act which will, and that separate act is not responsible. It could be any act of Parliament. It says money that you receive, for instance, the Auditor General, money that the Auditor General receives, does not go to the National Revenue Fund, as I understand. It goes into the budget of the Auditor General, because that is how the Auditor General functions. I'm saying that I know there's issues with the new funding model for the AG, so it would be with the same with Parliament, even before, at this point in time, we do not have a proper act in place. Parliament does not pay the money that we receive from donors into the national revenue. Parliament keeps that, and that is in terms of an act. That's in terms of the PFMA. The issue of rollover funds are more complicated, but I'm not going to go there. But section 13 of the PFMA, all money received by the national government must be paid into the National Revenue Fund, except money received by Parliament, the national public entity, the South African Reserve Bank, etc. Okay, we've heard about the examples of, I hope I can bring some clarity. I agree with National Treasury that lawyers answer policy questions rather than. I never went to policy school, I went to law school. But I'm not in that money, so I do not get it. The issue of norms and standards has been addressed in a certain extent, but I wanted to add something to that, Honourable Chair. Now I've got my mind. It will come back now.
Question of clarity is in respect of officials determining the budget of departments. Yes, departments make budget bets, and there is an official interaction in terms of interrogating how the budget meets the obligations of that department, but it is cabinet that takes that decision, and it's also a committee of ministers. So it is clearly a political decision. It's not Verena and me or any of our DDGs that decide who gets what. Just to clarify, it is indeed a political decision.
Okay, I won't go into that debate. Some of us know exactly how things work in real life.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I just wanted to draw the committee's attention to clause 51 of the bill we're discussing, if possible. And this goes to the norms and standards and the report and the gains in 2004, which I agree with. That is the intention of the Constitution, so that the public at large can know what's happening with taxpayers' money. 51 requires that there's a monthly reporting to the executive authority and national treasury, in a format determined by the executive authority. Now, as I said there, one can say these determinations by the executive authority must take into account the general norms and standards in government departments as a whole. But a I'm just trying to draw your attention that there is a reporting obligation. National Treasury will get the information in terms of this, if compliance is enforced by 51. In terms of that, in terms of our revenue and expenditure and liability, etc. So that is there. The reporting is there.
I don't know. I would have loved us to break, and when we break here, we'll break. I don't want to meet tomorrow. But when we meet tomorrow, please, nobody will be preparing for debate because of the time. We will only be coming here to deal with financial management of Parliament and nothing else. And that is why I want to focus today on the present. We must come along this year. Final night.
And
members, I've also we've also circulated to members a letter. I'm closing the financial management department until tomorrow. But there's a letter that has been circulated to members, which is written urgent in bold. This letter comes from the attorneys who represent a company named Day One Health, Pty Limited. Written on the 13th of June 2008. I only came to know about this letter yesterday. It was not written to us, it was sent to the Speaker of the National Assembly, the Chairman of the National Council of Provinces. And it says there, the Chairman of the Portfolio Committee on Finance, Mr. Edmere, by email, A. Herman. Mr. Herman has indicated that we also never received this letter. He was here this morning because I wanted to know why. If you had received it, why it didn't then was not passed on to me. But in any sense, this letter says that we did not meet our constitutional responsibility of consultation on the challenge clause matter. But if members could just read the letter, and I would want to submit that as we had passed this piece of legislation in this committee, we are proceeding with the debate in the House. It will go through to the NCOP. If there is any attempt to stop it, they have every right to do so, to challenge what we have done. But as far as we are concerned, in fact, amongst the people that came before the committee and even complained about the bill not, about National Treasury or the consultation process not being adequate, we never received anything from day one. It has not even happened. That's the difficulty of the open-ended consultation process. But I was just bringing it to the members and for your attention. If you look at this letter, it was written on the 30th of June at 12:17 and forwarded to the Speaker. And if you look at the last paragraph of the letter, it says that the Speaker. We await to hear from you by 1300 on the 13th of June. It means they were giving the Speaker also 43 minutes to respond. It's very interesting. The Speaker was supposed to respond within 43 minutes. Very interesting. All in the name of participatory and openness. Gives everybody an opportunity to engage and respond. So that's where we are. I'm informed also that I'm making a grave mistake by ending this meeting now because there is lunch at 12. But they see now, members are free to come back for lunch at 12, but they see outside for now. And this meeting is adjourned until tomorrow, 10:00 p.m.